From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program...
Since I took office, I've made clear my determination to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
President Obama's reaction to the historic deal over Iran's nuclear future, but the breakthrough agreement has been hit by a barrage of criticism. Also, we're in Ukraine, where tear gas has been fired at crowds protesting the government's decision to turn its back on EU trade, and discover the bizarre account of what happened on the Greenpeace ship when it was boarded by Russian commandos. And also today, why 18 million American insomniacs could soon be waking up to a new form of therapy.
It's very, very successful. About 40 to 50% of patients notice that their insomnia completely remits and they don't have any problems with it for a very long time.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of our latest news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster.
This is a yellow alert message. Today is November 25th at 11:55 a.m. There are confirmed reports of a person with a gun on campus. This is not a test.
These harrowing words greeted students of esteemed Yale University in the U.S. state of Connecticut this morning. In an all-too-familiar scene, students were forced to shelter while police searched for a gunman threatening the campus's peace. No injuries were reported, but the gunman is still at large. The incident occurred just as the one-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in nearby Newtown, Connecticut, drew near. On Monday, authorities issued an official report of the Sandy Hook child massacre, detailing the events and security measures that took place that day. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he'll send a team to Washington for talks with the U.S. on a nuclear deal with Iran. It comes after Netanyahu described this weekend's deal as a historic mistake. The six-month agreement sees Iran freeze its most sensitive nuclear activity in exchange for $7 billion worth of sanctions relief. Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington.
Officials in Washington have been quick to stress that the Geneva Accord is merely an interim agreement, while a more comprehensive and hard-line permanent deal is worked out over the next 6 months. That's in part an attempt to pacify key regional ally Israel. It says the deal is too lenient and reduces the pressure on Iran. It's also made it clear that Israel's not bound by the terms of the deal, an implicit threat that the military option remains on the table. Barack Obama telephoned the Israeli Prime Minister on Sunday night and agreed that a team led by National Security Advisor Yossi Cohen will head to the US in the coming days to discuss the accord, an attempt to strengthen the two allies' relationship on a divisive issue. But trust between Washington and Tel Aviv has been eroded after the revelation that US officials held top-secret negotiations with the Iranians for months before the Geneva talks, without informing Israel.
January 22nd, that's the day Syria's government and opposition will finally convene in Geneva for a long-delayed peace conference. The UN Secretary General announced the date and expressed hope that it could put an end to the three-year civil war. From UN headquarters in New York, Stephen Fee has our report.
Originally scheduled for this past May, the so-called Geneva II talks will be the first meeting of Syria's government and opposition forces since the war began. Over 100,000 people have died and millions displaced since the war began 3 years ago. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the conference would convene with the aim of creating a transitional government with control over the military and Syria's overall security forces. But doubts remain. The UN has not disclosed who exactly will represent the opposition, a point that has fueled delays in the long-scheduled peace negotiations, and the exact role of regional neighbors Iran and Saudi Arabia has yet to be defined.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The American Automobile Association says over 43 million Americans plan to travel over 50 miles this Thanksgiving holiday. But severe weather warnings pose danger for many as they hit the road. Nearly a dozen travelers have died already due to icy road crashes in the lead-up to Thursday's national holiday. Effects of the storm system are expected to touch nearly all parts of the country. In Honduras, Sunday's presidential election is turning into a contentious affair, as early results show a near tie. Andrea Arenas reports.
Over half of the votes have been accounted for so far, revealing that there is indeed a close tie between the two main candidates. According to preliminary results, the ruling party's candidate, Juan Orlando Hernandez, is headed for victory. But only 6 points behind is Xiomara Castro, the wife of former left-wing president Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in 2009 in a military coup. Xiomara Castro has declared herself the true president and complains of fraud, calling on her supporters to contest the results.
And tech giant Apple has purchased PrimeSense for $360 million. As California correspondent David Leonard explains, this could signal Apple's plans to move away from the mouse.
PrimeSense is an Israeli firm that uses 3D motion detection technology to allow people to use physical motion to control computers. PrimeSense has made strides in recent years, innovating mobile tracking and 3D scanning. Apple's deal is likely to spark speculation about its plans to develop new products such as Apple TV and could signal the silicon company to move away from the mouse interface to gesture-based interaction across many of its devices.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The US and its so-called P5 plus one partners have been holding secret and not-so-secret talks for many months on Iran's nuclear capability. Late Saturday night, President Obama addressed the nation to reveal the outcome of those negotiations.
That diplomacy opened up a new path toward a world that is more secure. A future in which we can verify that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful and that it cannot build a nuclear weapon.
The historic but temporary agreement they forged will require Iran to halt some of its nuclear energy activities, get rid of some of its stockpiled materials, and open its facilities to international inspectors. In return, the US and other countries will temporarily ease up on some of the tough sanctions that have decimated Iran's economy for decades, but the deal is already facing a barrage of international and domestic criticism. In Washington, D.C., Alice Ulstein has the details.
Just days after President Obama announced the conditions of a deal to ensure Iran only uses its nuclear infrastructure for peaceful energy purposes, several members of Congress and international allies panned the deal, calling it dangerous and a mistake. But other world leaders and experts are praising the accord as a historic first step toward a lasting deal to limit and monitor Iran's nuclear program. Lee C. Healy with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation said the agreement made in Geneva this past weekend, quote, stops Iran's nuclear program in its tracks.
It essentially stops all of Iran's 20% enrichment. They will blend down all of their 20% enriched uranium. It puts caps on their lower enriched uranium. It stops the installation of more centrifuges in their facilities, and it stops their facility at their plutonium facility at Iraq that had a lot of concern surrounding it in the last stages of these negotiations. So this is a really, really great deal. It also puts the most intrusive inspections regime ever negotiated into place. Iran will be subject to daily inspections on its nuclear facilities, ensuring that the international community can make sure that it's not building a nuclear weapon. And that's much more than we've ever had before.
The partner nations will resume negotiations with Iran almost immediately to try to hammer out a permanent deal in the next 6 months. The United States and the European Union will also begin lifting some of the economic sanctions on Iran as early as December. Healy explained that the sanctions relief in the temporary agreement will mostly benefit middle-class Iranian civilians.
The specific measures focus primarily on airplane parts, airplane safety, transportation, and student visas overseas. Students have been strongly affected by these sanctions. So the sanctions relief on the table right now focuses on taking some of that pressure off of the people, because the pressure should be on the Iranian regime. The pressure should be on the nuclear program and not on the people.
The sanctions against Iran's oil exports and participation in international banking will remain in place for now, but could be eased in a final agreement. In a speech late Saturday night, President Obama thanked Congress for upholding these sanctions for many years, but pleaded with them not to vote on additional measures to punish Iran while the sensitive negotiations are still underway.
Over the last few years, Congress has been a key partner in imposing sanctions on the Iranian government, and that bipartisan effort made possible the progress that was achieved today. Going forward, we will continue to work closely with Congress. However, now is not the time to move forward on new sanctions, because doing so would derail this promising first step, alienate us from our allies, and risk unraveling the coalition that enabled our sanctions to be enforced in the first place.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has said that if there are new sanctions from the U.S., the deal is off. But many members of Congress are still calling for additional sanctions. In a statement released over the weekend, Florida Republican Marco Rubio wrote, quote, "There is now an even more urgent need for Congress to increase sanctions until Iran completely abandons its enrichment and reprocessing capabilities." Some members of the president's own party agree. New York Democrat Charles Schumer called the interim deal disproportionate and said he is currently discussing additional sanctions with his colleagues. Because these and other lawmakers have vowed to continue pushing for sanctions when they return to work in early December, Healey said it's crucial for the U.S. public to weigh in now if they want to support a peaceful deal and prevent an armed conflict. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
The deal with Iran to slow its progress on its nuclear ambitions exceeded expectations, something FSN's Priscilla Huff discussed with longtime American diplomat Ambassador Thomas Pickering.
Most of us who followed this closely were pleased that they got a deal. We're even more pleased when we read the terms of the deal because they exceeded what I think were very low expectations we had going into these negotiations. And it seems as if the U.S. and the others had put together an extremely good, well-balanced deal.
And yet the Israelis, who are probably most closely threatened by the prospect of Iran actually becoming a nuclear weapons power, are absolutely furious. Do you think their concerns, their anger is well-placed? What do you think of the Israeli reaction?
I think the Israeli reaction is based on the threats that have been made against Israel by Iranian leaders, unfortunately repeated last week, I understand, by the Supreme Leader, that have been annihilationist and all the rest. And they fear very much an Iran with a nuclear weapon, and as a result have taken what can only be the most worst-case series of assumptions about this arrangement, a part of which I think do not hold up under careful examination. For example, they believe that the sanctions relief which has been given, which is quite small in comparison with the totality of sanctions which remain in place, will lead to their unraveling. They believe the deal was a mistaken deal because it did not immediately create a zero enrichment status for Iran, which they believe is important in slowing down or stopping any capability on the part of Iran to manufacture nuclear weapons. Now, the rest of the world, I think, is more prepared to accept the fact that the sanctions are not in jeopardy, that they serve a useful purpose in assuring Iran's compliance, and that the cessation of enrichment above 5%, as well as the agreement not to enlarge the stockpile of enriched material and to dispose of the stockpiles of 20% enriched material, as well as stopping effectively the work on the Arak heavy water reactor, are all real advances and are important contributions to reducing the concern that Iran might create an immediate breakout from its present status to a nuclear weapon.
Do you think that the fact that American and Iranian officials are actually really interacting on many levels is a step in the right direction?
Of course I do. I think that 33 years of separation, with rare exceptions, and often they ended up in misunderstandings and worse, have led to a very deep level of mistrust. That is certainly self-evident in Israel. It's certainly self-evident among many Americans. It's certainly highly prevalent in the Congress. The president and the secretary have their work cut out for them. That is, in fact, self-executing. That is, if it goes awry because of Iranian cheating, then the deal falls apart and we go back to our sanctions regime.
FSN's Priscilla Huff talking to Ambassador Thomas Pickering. This is FSN Reports. The Ukrainian capital, Kiev, is seeing its largest gathering of anti-government protesters since the Orange Revolution in 2004. Hundreds of thousands of opposition demonstrators across the country are pressuring the government to sign a political deal with the European Union at an upcoming conference, even though Ukrainian President Yanukovych has already backed out. The EU says the offer remains on the table until the deadline next week, but Brussels is blaming Russia for threatening Ukraine with sanctions if it signs. Our correspondent in Brussels, Sandra Gatman, reports.
On the aptly named European Square outside the Cabinet of Ministers building in Kiev, anti-government protesters clashed with police. Tear gas was fired in an attempt to contain growing anger over President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to call off a political deal with the European Union scheduled for next week. The so-called association agreement promised closer political and trade relations with EU countries. But Kiev admits it's not ready to cut ties with neighboring Russia, who want Ukraine to join its customs union together with Belarus and Kazakhstan. It's a prospect, though, not everyone in Ukraine supports, prompting protesters to take to the streets over the weekend in numbers not seen since the 2004 Orange Revolution. Oleg Rybachuk is an ex-vice prime minister for European integration and one of the main opposition rally organizers in Kiev.
First, we had like 50 people at night. Then hundreds, then thousands. Today we have again thousands. But yesterday, three major political parties also called for a rally to support EU. And yesterday we had around 100,000 people in the street.
He says many feel betrayed by President Yanukovych's U-turn.
I'm ready to commit whatever was discussed. I am going to Vilnius to sign the agreement. And then suddenly, last minute, this crazy decision of the government that this agreement with EU is the threat to national security. It's psycho incomprehensible. No one is buying that. The people are actually furious.
Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych is already under fire for the imprisonment of former leader Yulia Tymoshenko. She's seeking treatment in Germany for back problems, and her release was one of the preconditions for the deal set by the EU. But there's been additional pressure from Moscow, who've threatened to cut off Ukraine's gas supplies and impose trade restrictions if it joined the Western Bloc. On Monday, European Commission and Council President José Manuel Barroso and Herman Van Rompuy criticized Russia's actions in their joint statement read by spokeswoman Pia Archangilde.
We believe that short-term considerations should not override the long-term benefits that this partnership would bring, and the two presidents take note also that Ukrainian citizens have again shown these last days that they fully understand and embrace the historic nature of the European Association. Continuing, we therefore strongly disapprove of the Russian position.
The door to the EU, though, they say, remains open. The question now is how far this political tug of war has dented Yanukovych's re-election prospects. Internal polls reveal more than half of his party supporters are pro-EU, a substantial voter base he may have just lost forever, though the subject of EU integration is not going away anytime soon and may well dominate political campaigns in the run-up to elections next year. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
Staying in the region for a moment, and American Peter Wilcox, better known as the captain of the Greenpeace ship involved in the recent Arctic protest, has been released on bail after 2 months in Russian detention. The activists were initially charged with piracy for protesting at a Russian-owned Arctic oil platform, but have since seen the charge drop to hooliganism, although it could still carry a 7-year prison sentence. In his interview with the New York Times, Captain Wilcox talked about the hardship of his detention and the surreal events he says took place on the Arctic Sunrise vessel when it was first boarded by Russian commandos. Our Moscow correspondent Anya Ardayeva spoke to me earlier.
The activists have been released on bail, but they're not allowed to leave the country just yet because the trials are waiting to still to happen on whether they have committed what the prosecutors say they've committed, an act of hooliganism, and those trials are to be held within the next 2 months. For the time being, those activists are free, and those of them who are Russian citizens can go home and see their families, but the other ones will have to remain in Russia.
One of those released on bail was Captain Peter Wilcox, and he's been giving an interview of his account of events since his detention began.
That's right. An American, Peter Wilcox, who is the captain of the Arctic Sunrise ship, and he gave his first interview over the phone to the New York Times, and in that interview he described his detention and the jail time that followed. In that conversation he said the way the 30 activists were arrested in September was quite scary. He said about a dozen commandos descended on a ship wearing balaclavas, and they were armed with machine guns. He said they locked most of the crew members in their cabins, and added that the first thing the commandos did was seizing everybody's alcohol and drinking it. He said that this could be linked to what is known as some sort of maritime tradition from the old days, when the first thing found on board by an invading crew was the rum.
What did Captain Wilcox say about the nature of his detention and the conditions he was kept in?
Peter Wilcox said that his detention was quite challenging, and he recalled a moment when he was contemplating whether he would spend another 10 years in Russia. Now, the city of Murmansk, where the activists were held, is located up north, and there's very little sunlight there at this time of the year. And that certainly didn't add to the living conditions in that jail. He said he was served fish heads too, which he enjoyed, but also cold mashed potatoes with herring, and that, he said, didn't quite go so well.
And can you tell me a bit about how this story, now rumbling on for 2 months, is being viewed in Russia? What's the reaction been where you are in Moscow?
The reaction to this case is very mixed in Russia, of course. There is a certain part of the society, I would say the majority of the society, which only gets what is shown on Russian state television. And they certainly share the official point of view, which is that the activists were not simply trying to protest oil drilling in the Arctic, but they tried to seize the platform. And that, as authorities say, endangered the lives of the people working there and created conditions that could result in a possible breakage of very sensitive equipment that is installed on that platform. But there is also another part of the society which says that the Russian response to this protest action is disproportionate, and that the people who were on board that ship need to be released as soon as possible.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Anya Ardayeva. Now, 18 million Americans suffer with depression, and the majority of those struggle to get a good night's sleep. Experts are agreed that insomnia is one of the most common side effects of depression, but new research suggests that a specially designed cognitive behavioural therapy could ease insomnia and double the effectiveness of treatment for depression. FSN's Kate Fisher has been speaking to Dr. Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioural Sleep Medicine Programme at Montefiore Medical Centre in the Bronx. She began by asking her how important it is to combat the inability to sleep.
There have been studies that show that upwards of a half of all Americans have actually had some symptoms of insomnia here and there, maybe not meeting the diagnostic criteria, but at least half of Americans. But we've seen that about 15% of all Americans actually have chronic insomnia. Insomnia is something that really cuts across many different medical and psychiatric diagnoses, and it's something that really... Insomnia and just sleep disorders in general is something that's not really given much attention.
Imagine I'm your patient. I come to you and I say, you know, I've had several months now where I'm really not getting a good night's sleep. I wake up most nights. I can't get back to sleep. It's really affecting me. How would you go about using this therapy? How would you go about treating me?
So the first step for CBT, or cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, would be to have someone do a thorough evaluation to make sure there's no other medical or psychiatric illness that's actually truly causing the problem. And then the other thing that's really important is you can get a sleep diary online. There are a lot of different versions of sleep diaries. And to really track your sleep for at least 1, ideally 2 weeks, to see what your patterns are. And then once we get a diary for a week or two, then we'll start to look at maybe changing the sleep window that someone is in bed. So a lot of people tend to, with insomnia, tend to spend too many hours in bed when they're only sleeping a portion of that. And that can be really difficult for a lot of patients to do. But instead of trying to force sleep to happen when you're laying in bed, we try to meet the body where it is and just sleep the only the amount of hours that you're actually sleeping every night and spend only that amount of time in bed. Make sure that the patient only uses the bed for sleep and sex. And a lot of people say they've tried it, but it's something that really needs to be done on a consistent basis. Doing it for a few nights here and there is not enough. So really, if you get in bed and you don't fall asleep and your brain is active, get up, go sit somewhere else, do something quiet, calm, and relaxing, and only get back in bed again when you're asleep or when you're sleepy. And if you don't fall asleep, get up again and go sit somewhere else. And you do that on and off during that prescribed sleep window that we would give them.
How successful have you found this therapy has been?
It's
it's very, very successful. About 40 to 50% of patients notice that their insomnia completely remits and they don't have any problems with it for a very long time. I've seen rates even a little bit higher of about 60% of patients might not be fully cured, but they notice that they're sleeping more solidly throughout the night and they're having much more condensed sleep. So it's actually, out of all the psychotherapies, it's one of the most effective therapies that we actually have for a disorder.
FSN's Kate Fisher talking to Dr. Shelby Harris. Now, the tech sector in London is growing increasingly dominant. Startups, as well as big players like Google, Amazon and Microsoft, are setting up around East London's Old Street Roundabout, or Circle here in the US, earning it the name Silicon Roundabout. The sector is expected to become increasingly important to the British economy, as our UK correspondent Natalie Feary found out.
Startup company Depop is building an app which enables users to set up an online shop at the click of a mobile phone button. Depop was founded in Milan, but is among the huge number of tech startups that have flocked to East London's tech city. Runa Reistrup, chief operating officer at Depop, says the company was weighing up the options of going to Berlin or London before deciding on the latter.
It has a lot of support functions around, so good PR companies, good accountants, everyone gets the kind of startup economy that's important, and then it's the abundance of talent.
Just next door is Google Campus, where tech entrepreneurs can get advice, attend workshops and network. Government initiatives are playing a significant role in helping startups get off the ground. These include tax breaks as well as entrepreneur visas. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, has pledged £50 million of investment for the area in East London known as Tech City, part of which will go towards building a tech hub by 2015. But raising money remains a challenge. Investors in the UK are still seen as much more risk-averse than their counterparts in the US. So they are being given incentives, says Steve Karminski, the founder of technology investment firm City Meets Tech.
Investors get 50% off their income tax and up to 50% off their capital gains tax in the same year. So if you're a high net worth, you obviously can, if you're allowed to invest up to £100,000 a year into startups, and the government's writing 64% of that in the same year that you invest.
And as London's tech hub booms, companies are taking notice of the advantages Silicon Roundabout offers over Silicon Valley in the US. Oliver Smith, Commercial Director for Europe, the Middle East and Africa of media company Unruly, says there is no better place to be situated for those working with major global brands.
We're quite often on the phone to Singapore in the morning and then taking calls from San Francisco and so on in the evening. And so it's a very logical place for a lot of global companies to do business and organise their marketing communications.
Cisco, Microsoft and Amazon are among others setting up shop in the area. The tech sector in the UK is performing so well that it is becoming a major driving force for the British economy. Rob Harbron, a senior economist at the Centre for Economics and Business Research, has dubbed the tech industry the flat white economy because the drink is so popular in cafes in the area of London where digital companies are based.
We've seen employment in central London in this sector, which we call the flat white economy, booming to around 160,000 jobs, up from about 90,000 jobs 10 years ago. The rate of growth has far exceeded financial services in particular, which took a massive hit during the downturn 2008-2009. And it's also been growing much faster than business services as a whole, so traditional accounting, that sort of thing.
Harbron predicts that the flat white economy will grow at twice the rate of the once dominant financial sector over the next 5 years. Natalie Feary, London.
And that's Monday's edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, at Feature Story. Join us again tomorrow. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.